I would like, first of all, to offer my sincere thanks to all those who have taken the trouble to organize this meeting, and also to all of you who are present here for gracing this meeting with your presence. To hear a person who is, I think, a complete stranger to the majority of you. Thank you very much indeed. And I hope you will find that it has been worthwhile in some respect or other to have come to this meeting and contributed your inspirational influence by your presence. Yoga spells the complete reversal of the ordinary human condition. The subhuman is transformed by yoga into the full-fledged human. I'm not using the word subhuman in any pejorative sense. I wouldn't dream of doing that. I'm using that word only to indicate that the mass of human beings in the world have not yet reached their full development as humans. What is the meaning, the profound meaning of the word human? If you look into the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is one of the oldest and the greatest of the Brahmanical Upanishads, you will find a remarkable statement made. The term used is Purusha, and Purusha in Kamanagarden terms simply means a person. What was their presentation of the idea of a person? They present a very interesting and somewhat quaint philology with respect to the word Purusha. And it means, in straightforward English, one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. Now that's an extraordinarily significant statement, because it immediately introduces us to a dimension of consciousness and being which is still a distant goal for all of us. Now, through the ages there have always been a few, the first fruits of our humanity, we may call them, who have realized this state, which is a state of supreme beatitude, of supreme fulfillment as human beings. And the fulfillment, do remember, is not so much an attainment or achievement by the individual human, but through his work of purifying himself, through the gathering of self-knowledge and dedicating himself to the transcendent reality, the one total reality, which is everything that we know plus what we do not know, this transcendence, this total reality, comes to fruition as the perfected Holy One through that individual. You will find in the teachings of the great religions of the world that the individual is called the temple of the Lord. The dweller of that temple is the Lord Himself. Our business as individuals is to be the perfect caretaker of this temple. And when the temple is utterly clean, utterly receptive, with no obtrusion of selfness, then that which functions through us is not our will or thought or ideal or any such thing, but transcendence itself. And the stream of human life flows through the perfected yogi in all its fullness without any hindrance from petty selfness, from subhumans. Now inevitably, we, not being there yet, are still growing towards that. And that is why I use the word subhuman simply to mean that we are not yet the perfect human, the Purusha in this transcendental sense, which is the full human sense. Now, yoga is something which goes far back in time, at least 5,000 years, and in all likelihood, much longer than that. In connection with our human race as it is structured today, you know that the human organism has evolved through some millions of years from one kind of structure through a series of changes till men and women look and function as they do today. Now, I mentioned 5,000 years. When researches were made in connection with the Indus Valley civilization in India, several seals and amulets and betelic rings and stones were found which had carvings on them. And the very important seal which was discovered, which connects us with yoga, is a seal depicting a god in a yogic pose. And this civilization and these seals which those Indus Valley people made were somewhere around 3000 BC. So that takes us about 5,000 years back. And Sir John Marshall, who was Director General of Archaeology then, gave it as his opinion that this little figure on the Shiva seal, on the seal, represented the god Shiva, the third person of the Hindu Trinity, in a yogic pose. A pose which was there not as a practice for Shiva, but as representing divinity which emerges out of living yoga. It is a transcendental significance that we must hold on to. So, yoga is something very, very ancient. And the first compilation of yogic teachings come in the Upanishads. In the Shandilya Upanishad, which is one of the yoga Upanishads, you see there are 108 at least of these Upanishads. Some deal with certain aspects, the so-called great Upanishads, deal principally with the exposition of Brahman and Atma and what they mean and signify. But the real key to them lies in the Yoga Upanishads, which are very difficult to obtain. In the Shandilya Upanishad, Shandilya asks his teacher, Atharvan, what are the eight limbs of yoga? And Atharvan's answer is yama, the practice of the moralities, niyama, the religious observances, asana, the postures, pranayama, the control of the breath. In addition to the control of the breath, one could certainly say the right utilization of the rhythm of the breath. This is an aspect which is of extreme importance in the life of the yogi. Then comes pratyahara, which is of fundamental importance to all practices of yoga. It's usually translated as the withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. But I will talk a little bit more about that later on. And then come the three crowning aspects of the real yoga. Dharana, as it is called, I'll define dharana later on. Dhyana, which I think all of you know, usually translated as meditation or concentration. And finally, samadhi, the culmination of the meditative state and the meditative practice. Let us start with the first two, the yamas and the niyamas. They are the indispensable basis for all yogic practice. Indispensable. And they are always stated first. The Chandilya Upanishad presents 10 niyamas. In Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, you get only 5. In some of the other Upanishads, you get a smaller number than that which the Chandilya gives. And in one or two, I have found more than what the yamas and niyamas enumerated in the Chandilya Upanishad. I think that book by Mr. Iyengar, Light on Yoga, gives you an exposition, the preliminary exposition, in the manner in which Patanjali has presented. And Patanjali presents only 5 of each. So you can look that up, or you can look other treatises, other translations of the aphorisms in your own books. But they form an indispensable basis. We must appreciate this point very, very deeply. If this basis of purity in everyday life of the body and the psyche is not present, a discipline like yoga can be shattering. It can do more harm in the long run than good. I'll come to that when we talk a little bit about the asanas. Now, we must appreciate that morality, the yamas and so forth, and the niyamas, the religious observances, in the religious sense and context, is not merely the social or political or civic sense based on reciprocity, but in the absolute or transcendental sense. You know how man throughout the world is able to run society only on the basis of reciprocity. One has to behave rightly in relation to his fellow man, and his fellow man has to respond by behaving rightly to the other person. It's a reciprocal relationship. It lies therefore in the sphere of dualism, in the sphere of ambivalence. Now, this is something quite different from the transcendental sense in which all the great founders of the religions talked of morality. they spoke of not a ambivalent reciprocal ethic, but of a transcendental absolute ethic. Take the simple teaching of harmlessness, or if you like to put it in the other form, loving kindness, love your neighbor, love God, etc., etc. But it is absolute, meaning therefore, whatsoever you do unto me, you will always have nothing but love in its profoundest sense from me. Now if one thinks, I should say, meditates deeply, calmly upon this, one will see that the transcendental context is a context of eternity. It's a context of creative power of a nature which is still foreign to us. Science has investigated energy in so many forms to a remarkable extent, but we know them as secondary forms which need an apparatus for manifestation, be it electrical energy, chemical energy, whatever the energy is. But this creative energy, which is creative action in eternity, is something which the brain simply cannot get hold of. But what we can do at our level is to bear in mind the transcendent nature of the morality which the great religions have taught. In both Hinduism and in Buddhism, as well as in Christianity, the teaching is to be truthful, harmless, etc., not only outwardly in action, but in thought, in feeling, in speech, and in action. In short, in terms of our total psychophysical being and activities. This is a very, very important point, and you will see that it is rather a tall order. But the great teachers laid this down. And they laid it down as the indispensable preliminary before proceeding to the asanas and pranayama. Now why? The way of yoga is the way of power and the utilization of power, the utilization of tremendous forces. And as you know, throughout the world's history, power has been invariably and inevitably misused and misapplied, largely simply because this preliminary basis of true morality, the fruition and harmony of perfect love and wisdom, was not there as the basis. If that is not there, every power which comes into our hands, the first thing we do with it is to misapply it. The man who invented the bow and arrow, terrible instruments they were of destruction, first use of them. We know all that from history. So now, we see the necessity for this transcendental morality being established in us, or at least being considerably on the way towards it, and holding it carefully in our minds, and being attentive to everything we do, so that we may observe carefully that we do not contravene transcendental morality. And then proceeding to the asanas and pranayama. Now the postures. What do the postures do? let us ask ourselves another question in relation to it. Why do we practice the postures? Because they help us to be healthy, to be well, to enjoy life, to be free of disease, to succeed in our ambitions and work and our man-made ideals. All that is projected out of our imperfect minds and in some cases still less perfect hearts, all of it lies deep below in the subconscious depths of the mind. Is it a keep fit system of a different sort? It certainly is a keep fit system of a different sort. But what is the important difference? Where lies the seriousness of it? The purpose of the postures is so to understand and discipline the body that it no longer offers any obstruction to the yogi when he goes into the real depths of yoga, namely meditation and the process of complete at-one-ment in mind and consciousness with the total reality, with transcendence itself. That is the fundamental purpose of the asanas. This. You know how in Plato's Symposium Alcibiades apologizes for Socrates' absence from the banquet that evening. Why? Because it was towards sundown that Socrates was proceeding to the banquet, and a problem arose in his mind, and he suddenly stood still, just like that, concentrating his mind upon the problem, meditating, being in touch through his daemon with transcendent reality. That, of course, Plato omitted to state. Remember, Plato was one of the great ones who knew that the supreme mysteries must not be divulged to the masses. Now, of course, the Greeks saw Socrates do this and they got very curious. They brought their mattresses out and spread them out, knowing that Socrates was likely to stand there for a long time. They wanted to know just how long he was going to stand. He stood there for the whole night, meditating, and by sunrise the solution had come, and he offered up a prayer and went his way. Now, I can't stand the whole night meditating like that. Can you? The Buddha is another remarkable example. He tells some Jains who came to him to discuss matters with regard to the supreme good, the supreme happiness, and they spoke about being in deep meditation. And the Buddha assured them that he could stay in the ultimate samadhi for 7 nights and 7 days without moving. Now, just try and picture this as a human possibility. What sort of a discipline had the psychophysical organism, Siddhartha the Buddha, gone through that he had undergone this complete transformation out of the subhuman state into the full-fledged human? These are just one of the powers that the full-fledged human possesses. They are his. Those are two examples. Another point. through the asanas and pranayama, the organism, the psychophysical organism, yourself, the living person, having your name, John Smith or Mary Brown or whatever it is, the organism is converted into a fit receptacle, a holy grail for the inflow and outflow of the main archetypal manifestations of the primordial creative power, the primordial creative energy, which brings the entire universe into being, and which sets the purposes for which the different kingdoms of nature exist. Now, this is something really tremendous. And this is one of the reasons why that essential, that indispensable basis of morality must be present. Because these archetypal forces, which can be released just through the asanas and through the breathing, particularly through the breathing, will shatter the impure man. The Buddha talks, for instance, the Buddha was as great a yogi as any yogi ever was. He talks in one of his discourses of the good man and the bad man. Now note this very carefully, it is so significant. He says that the good man can enter this stage of meditation, so can the bad man. Then the next deeper stage, the good man can enter, so can the bad man. Right up to one but the last stage. Both can enter therein. But the one who is not completely and utterly purified cannot enter the last one. It's extremely significant that the paths of God and the devil go parallel for such a distance. And when it comes to the ultimate stage, the devil goes back to his warm home and the Lord stays intact. So we must remember this very carefully. Now, the purpose of pranayama, the breath rhythm, your own breath rhythm has to be established first. Because you, every one of us, is a unique individual. That is the miracle of this transcendent creative energy of the universe. That its multitudinous variety represents the embodiment of the beauty, the perfection, the indescribable, infinite marvel of its manifestations, through its many manifestations. And yet this one transcendent reality is one unitary whole, which is the multitudinous many. And the multitudinous many, each one of them, are integral part and parcel of this one transcendent whole. So now, breathing, your normal breath rhythm, when you are yourself are in the calm state, is the expression of your life rhythm. Do remember that. And your life rhythm, therefore, is now in rhythm with, in tune with, the universal life rhythm. And in that state, together with the asanas, together with the moralities and religious observances, puts you into touch with the universal in a whole sense, not merely in your thinking or your feeling, not merely in terms of intellect or emotion, but in this transcendental manner, which remains unknown to the individual, unknown by the brain, It is experienceable, but it is not statable. One can only try and give a lucid explanation which is less misleading than the explanations which have been given hitherto. That is as far as one can do at our level here in terms of the functioning of the senses and the logical discursive thought process of the brain. The brain is the concretest expression of mind in its wholeness. So now that is the purpose of pranayama, that your life rhythm gets into harmony with the cosmic rhythm. Now, asanas and pranayama are not a keep-fit system in any of the senses in which other keep-fit systems exist in the world. These asanas and pranayama must have been discovered through centuries of experience and experimentation, so that what was discovered was that they open up certain channels of communication. They activate what are called the nadis. A nadi is a river or a stream, if you like. Think of it not so much as the water flowing, but the river bed and the banks. This is what the nadis are. And they are the psychical correspondent of physical nerves. Do remember that. These so-called chakras are not something which you can put into a test tube or something one day and or invent some machine by which you will see these whirling things. These are symbolical ways of talking about and suggesting that which still lies outside the scope of our knowledge and experience. But they are stimulated, and when their stimulation takes place, certain physical results follow. Now, whether the physical results will be truly helpful, put you in line with the purposes of life itself, or whether through the faultiness of the apparatus, the psychophysical organism, through the lack of morality, will shatter you. See? That is why the moralities are so important. Now let us come to pratyahara. Now this is a word which has, as far as I am aware, been translated less adequately than we can translate it. Pratyahara is usually thought of as a withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. We all live in the world. Can we live in the world if there is a withdrawal of our sense functions from the objects of the world? We are very likely to walk into the very next car as we cross the street, and it is not likely that the one who does that will come off victorious after the collision. So we have to be extremely sensible. This is one of the great difficulties of thousands of idealistic people who want to live the ideal life, this ideal being projected out of the imperfect mind, remember, you see. Their trouble is that they tend to take leave of good sense. Now, I do not suggest for a moment that good sense is identical with what the world calls common sense. the world's common sense is truly common in the somewhat pejorative meaning of the word common. Not universally shared, but something which is undesirable. Good sense functions when, through careful observation, dispassionate observation, one frees oneself from biases, prejudices, preconceptions, and assumptions. If we do that, you will discover something quite extraordinary, that the ordinary senses which we have function in a different way, a much deeper, a profounder way, and in a much more reliable way. Reliable in this sense that you are able to use your senses and live from day to day in a manner which is truly in line with the creative forces of the world, which are moving mankind or inviting mankind to move in such a manner that he moves towards the true purpose of his existence, to be the Purusha, the one in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out, to be the perfect receptacle and apparatus through which the archetypal forces of the creative activity of the universe can function, without troubling you, without yourself therefore being a nuisance to society. Now, so much for the abstraction of the sense functions from objects of sense. So there is no question really of abstracting the sense functions from the objects of sense. We have to be in harmony with the whole thing. What Pratyahara really means is freedom from attachment on the one hand and from aversion on the other hand. All our sense experience in our daily physical life has a psychical reaction. The normal psychical reaction is simply this. A pleasant experience makes the psyche say, "Oh, I like this. I want more of it." And then, by repetition, there arises a craving from which the individual cannot free himself. And if we look carefully into the lives of human beings, we find that the satisfaction of our cravings, the lust for power, for possession, for pleasure, for all these things, the satisfaction of our cravings inevitably implies trouble, difficulty, conflict with some neighbor or other. If we undergo a painful experience, the psychical reaction is, "Oh, I don't like this. I want to get rid of it." Or, "I want to destroy the cause, the source of this painful experience." And thereby, there arises aversion, hatred. So, these two elements, greed and hatred, are two of the most powerful forces for evil in our individual lives and in the life of mankind as a whole. But if there is the right use of the senses, the right use, pleasure, happiness, the true happiness will inevitably come to us. In fact, we can't stop it. Look at nature. Look at the beauty and the perfection of so many unconscious actions and interchanges between man and man. They are sources of happiness which come undesired, unsought, and which we do not hold on to, do not try to grasp. You walk out of your front door and suddenly see a wonderful glittering starlit night, which makes you suddenly say, "Oh, how wonderful!" Now there you are in a state, momentarily at least, in communion with transcendence itself. And you can multiply such experiences thousands of times if only you remain awake, sensitive, and perfectly attentive to all these things. And you can be attentive to all this only through the use of your senses. So you see, no suppression of senses, no repression of the sense functions, and so forth. So this freedom from attachment and aversion, and attachment and aversion are prolific generators of our conditioning, which keeps us imprisoned in an evil condition, evil state, and therefore our life more or less is fruitless. We have not begun to see the purpose of our existence and to take true delight and joy that such is the purpose of our existence, something to which to grow into. So I think if we understand Pratyahara that way, it will be somewhat slightly less misleading than the usual way, which is an unpleasantly ascetic way in which Pratyahara is presented. And in this connection, do remember the meaning of true asceticism. What does a sculptor do? Say he has a block of marble or whatever it is, or stone. Takes his hammer and chisel and chips away this, that and the other part of that stone which is unessential, and he releases a marvelous statue, you see. The yogi, the religieux, the mystic, the truly human person is one who puts aside the unessentials. And this is the true meaning of the Greek ascesis, from which our word asceticism is derived. Be free of all unessentials. Watch, observe, use good sense, not common sense, use good sense, and be free of it all. And then you are the real ascetic. And with that sort of asceticism, you will be also the right trustee for all possessions or power that circumstance and your own life process may freely bring unto you. Asceticism doesn't mean that if you happen to be a millionaire or something, you must read some religious book or hear Firoz Mehta speak and say, "Oh, I give it all up." That is absurd. Life put you into that position. Be understanding and be a trustee for the right use of it all. This is the supreme good sense, if you like. You see? So, freedom from attachment and aversion means, therefore, also freedom from dualistic consciousness. Good, evil, kind, cruel, generous, mean, and so forth. From the ambivalence of the psyche, you'll be free from that, and the conflicts inevitably, ineluctably presented by that ambivalence. you are in a state of turmoil. Now that state of turmoil fundamentally lies where? In our mental life, our psycho-mental life. Look at this second aphorism of Patanjali. Yogas chitta vritti nirodha. Yoga is, or let me say, use another word. Yoga spells the dissolution of the fluctuations of the mental processes. The mind vacillates aimlessly, this way, that way, all through the day. Have you ever tried really to be attentive to the mental processes? Or have you tried meditation in the sense of suppressing the normal flow of the mental processes and forcibly attempting to concentrate the mind upon a particular subject or object? Because when you try to concentrate in that way, you are excluding the rest of the universe. But he in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out is in total communion constantly through the senses, which act as cords of communion with the total reality. The microcosm now being the perfect microcosm, the whole reality, the transcendent reality, the man come to fruition, functions through you unhindered. See? So this is very, very important. The mind, with its fluctuations, is the crucial point, because the psyche is the crucible of transformation for human beings. It's the crucible for transformation. So, the three stages, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi, that trinity is the most important part of the whole story. As and when all the preliminaries, right up to pratyahara, have reached the right sort of grade at least, then comes dharana. Now the word dharana is derived from the Sanskrit root dhri. Dhri means to uphold. What is it that we uphold or try to uphold? That, as far as I'm aware, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I've never read it anywhere. You uphold what was called from ancient times, way back in the Rig Veda, Ritta. Ritta means the eternal order of things which is inherent in the totality of manifestation. Every single manifested thing subsists in terms of that Ritta, this energy, this creative energy which brings the manifested thing into existence, maintains it, and then there follows the right sort of dissolution of that particular manifestation. Not death the destroyer, death the wages of sin, but death or transformation, which is the consummator, the perfector, the seal of divinity upon this particular manifestation. It is that which comes. And that Ritta, that unknown and unknowable power, which lies at the heart of all things is the origin of the order of the cosmos. In the Rig Veda, there are only 4 verses in one out of the 1,027 hymns of the Rig Veda, which speaks continuously of Rudra. But all the gods of the Rig Veda and all the other entities which are presented there are called sons of Rudra, sons of the eternal order of things, the great gods. The great gods of the Rig Veda, like the great gods of all the pantheons of all the cultures, represent in a name the awareness which individual mystics, yogis had of these archetypal expressions of transcendent energy. All the gods of the pantheons and the goddesses, etc., are embodied in each one of us. All the pantheons and all the so-called mythologies in relation to the gods and so forth are one of the most marvelous ways of the past for presenting to you a secret knowledge, the knowledge of your own psychology. Your own psychology in the imperfect state, as well as the psychology of the perfected human mind. You know how the Buddha is said to have stood for 7 days staring at the roots of the tree under which he sat when he reached enlightenment. Now, even assuming that the Buddha had botanical interests, is he going to stand 7 days and nights staring at the roots of a physical tree? What is this tree? It's the tree of life. The tree of life. What is this Garden of Eden in which the tree of life was planted? Your own living psychophysical organism. And the roots of the tree of life are your brain. And the trunk is your spine. And the branches are your nerves, and so forth. It's an upside down tree. When Jesus healed one of those blind men in the first stage, he asked him, "What do you see?" "I see men walking as trees," answered that yogi, that mystic, Jesus. Very significant. What is our tree like in relation to the earth? I mean, to an ordinary tree in the plant kingdom on the earth. The roots of a tree on the earth are geotropic. They point and grow downwards towards the center of the earth, which means they come to a full stop, supposing they could reach the center of the earth. That's the end. And the branches, etc., move upwards to a certain height, and that's that. But with this upside down tree, the roots, where do they point? To the zenith, to the infinite, to the transcendent, the immeasurable, the context of that supreme creative energy which brings forth the entire universe, including you and me. Isn't it extraordinary? And when we sit cross-legged in the first simple poses, you see, Mooladhara touches Mother Earth. And the roots of a tree before, just where the main root and the main trunk are, is again touching Mother Earth. So you see, our base touches the root of the tree, our our brain reaches up towards the illimitable heavens. These are deep significances attached to that. Now, when there is complete harmony this way, Mother Earth and Father Heaven, if you like, are in complete accord through the asanas. And the forces of life are stirred up and made to move harmoniously without shattering you, and the circuit between earth and heaven is completed through the yogi. Thereby, transcendent forces now meet no obstruction. So dharana means upholding rupta. Then we have this, mind you, these three particularly are always simultaneous, but you can't talk of them simultaneously. Dhyana. The fundamental meaning of dhyana is to pay attention. To pay attention. To be mindful. What sort of attention is this? And here is the most important point in connection with attentiveness and attention. Pay attention not in order that oneself may gain something which he is desiring. Attention, as far as the daily routine of life is concerned, we must exercise, because we have to go through a daily living process. So all the ordinary physical processes, your business activities, your cultural work and attainments and so forth, all that needs attention in the worldly sense of the meaning the word attention. But here you are attending where the religious life and the yogic life is concerned, you are attending selflessly. Totally selflessly. Otherwise your attentiveness becomes besmirched with the evil inside oneself which is not yet burnt out. You see? This is very important. Therefore, one approaches meditation expecting nothing, wanting nothing for oneself. And if one expects and wants nothing for oneself, one will be free of that slightly naive excuse, "Oh, I don't want it for myself, but for my family, my society, for mankind. I want to serve God." God doesn't need any servants. He gets on with his household work much more efficiently when no servants come interfering with his work. And this is something which is rather a severe blow to our pride, particularly spiritual pride. But it is good to have such blows to our pride. So, attend utterly selflessly. Ritta, this creative energy, knowing precisely how the universe shall move and grow and come to fruition. That is the thing which does the work of both God and man. Man's business is to be the temple which is utterly clean, which means that the psyche has become whole, free of ambivalence, free of beliefs, conceptions, desires, wants, and all the rest of it. And then the psyche is utterly transparent, so that the light of transcendence itself shines through. Then, for the first time, mind, the universal mind, in all its power and majesty, works through you. So, don't take to yoga for the sake of visions, for the sake of
enter into deep states of consciousness and so on, because they are all self-oriented. When there is the complete disappearance of all self-orientation, then there is no self, isolated self-consciousness obstructing the functioning of life in its fullness. In what state are you then? Then you are in the truly meditative state. You don't practice meditation in the sense of concentrating your brain attention, your brain attentiveness upon a particular subject or particular object. Not at all. You are in the truly meditative state. And the truly meditative state means the state of perfect communion. I'm using the word communion deliberately because I find it's the best possible English word. Samadhi, sangadhi, the supreme togetherness. Now, if you can feel it that way, the supreme togetherness of totality, not you and totality, because then again totality has been split up into a subject and an object. That barrier disappears altogether. No longer is there any separation between the conscious mind, so-called, and the unconscious mind and all that. These are all human inventions which haven't yet penetrated deeply enough into the reality which the great religions presented. In that meditative state, you realize silence, the true silence, the silence of eternity. You are in tune with the rhythm of eternity itself. And do remember that that silence is not the opposite of noise. That silence contains all sound. The sound which is the symphony of universal process, the entire cosmos, which is an emergence of manifested order, which one can know and perceive out of the unmanifested order, which is the original meaning of the word chaos, not disorder. See? Now these are the extraordinary things that can happen. You can actually experience them, not as a subject knowing what he is experiencing. That is why it is experienceable but not stateable. You know that wonderful verse in Isaiah chapter 66 verse 1. The heaven is my throne, the earth is my footstool. What sort of a house shall ye build for me? And what shall be my place of rest? And I'll give the answer of the Hebrew prophet in terms of what the yogi might say. This purified vehicle is your house. And your residence is here, right within my own heart. I am pointing here, but I don't mean physical heart. The meaning of the word hridaya is, of course, in the first instance, the physical heart. But it means the essential in anything and everything. That is the heart of the matter, as we say in the English language. Heart in that sense, you see. Here thou shalt reside, and with the dissolution of the body, thou shalt return to the unknown and unknowable heaven through the nadi known as the Brahmarandra, through the Sahasrara chakra. So Muladhara and Sahasrara find their complete fulfillment in the yogi's own being and body. In this state, and under these conditions, what happens to the yogi? The yogi has fully realized complete and utter aloneness. Not loneliness. Loneliness is separation from the rest of the universe. That's why one is miserable in loneliness. Aloneness means the one only. Which one? Not this particular manifestation of the totality, but the totality itself. Transcendence itself is the one only, the absolute all. See? And therefore, that aloneness, which is the transcendent unitary wholeness, functions through you, is in you, and shines through you. You will see what an extraordinary responsibility you as teachers of yoga have undertaken. Perhaps one begins to see that the yogi in the modern world, if he goes about it the right way, just as in the case of the religious, the mystic, or any such person, is a torchbearer of light. And you will light a light which was never seen on land and sea before. What an extraordinary destiny. One may call you the children of the new dawn, and you will be bringers of that new dawn to all mankind. You will never live to see it, of course, because there are 4,000 million on the globe. But the seed which you sow never dies. It undergoes all sorts of transformations, and in those transformations, it affects bit by bit, through ages and ages, all human beings who constitute one mankind.